A Philosophy of History, Part 1. The first talk in the series, Issues in a Biblical Worldview, was presented by David Crabtree on May 5, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and many of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Crabtree's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Well, I've been looking forward to doing this. I'm not sure exactly what I'm going to be doing the next 2 weeks, but I hope to have figured it out between now and then. But this is a great chance for me to be forced to pull some of my thoughts together, and I'm hoping that interact with you folks over these things and let me clarify thoughts on my own mind. What I want to do in this class is to summarize and bring together my thoughts with respect to the nature of history. I have been studying history for a few years now at the university, and so I have been doing a lot of thinking about the nature of history, partially as a result of courses that I have taken, which have asked me to think about such things, but for the most part, been on my own, just as I've been reading historical accounts and doing a little bit of research on my own. In my mind, it's unavoidable that I begin to ask myself, what is history and what is it worth? I have come to enjoy history very, very much. I think it is extremely intriguing because history is essentially a study of human beings. It is a study of human beings in aggregate for the whole part because individuals are, to a large extent, lost in history. Societies, groups of people for the most part. Individuals are there, but they aren't very distinct. So for the most part, you're looking at groups of people, but it is a wonderful chronicle, a wonderful lab book of experiments in what human beings do in different circumstances. So I find history absolutely fascinating. It is almost an endless source of thought-provoking information. And it is particularly interesting in our time, I think, given that we have so much history, so much recorded history. We've got about 5,000 years of recorded history. So we have experiments that span a long period of time, a lot of cultures, and so a lot of information that we can glean from to figure out what human beings are. The other thing that history helps us to do is understand the present. There's nothing happening today that does not have deep historical roots. This quarter I am a GTF and a Western Civ class, and the first topic that we started with talked about the quarter of the Industrial Revolution, and throughout the quarter we've been talking about the effects of the Industrial Revolution, and it is astounding. Virtually every aspect of our lives has been transformed from the way people lived before the Industrial Revolution dramatically. It's not just a quantitative change, it's a qualitative change, and that's true of any number of issues. They've all got deep historical roots, and you can't really understand the problem unless you understand its history, how it came to be. So history is fascinating. I think it's a very important field of study. And over these three lectures, I want to talk about the nature of history. Tonight, I want to talk about some of the very fundamental aspects of the philosophy of history, things that were never covered in my graduate school courses, but I've been forced to think about. In my graduate school courses, what they talk about in the course that should be the philosophy of history is historical methods. And in the second half of the lecture tonight, I'll talk about the various methods that were presented to us. And then over the next 2 weeks, I will give you my method. The method is just coalescing at this point. And hopefully it will be a little more coalesced next week than it is right now. a little bit with one of the trends in our generation. Okay, first of all, why a philosophy? Why even bother with a philosophy of history? When I started in graduate school, all graduate students in history were required to take a class called Historical Methods and Writing. And in the first lecture, the professor said that this was a course on the philosophy of history, but that a historian does not need to have a philosophy of history. There are many good historians without a philosophy of history. You don't need one. So the reason we offer this course is because it will look good on your transcript. And I thought, well, sign me up. That's a good reason. But I was horrified. That is impossible, inconceivable to me, that there could be a historian without a philosophy of history. The historian may not have a conscious philosophy of history, but there are a set of assumptions that that historian is proceeding upon, and that is that historian's philosophy of history. One of the greatest lackings, I think, in modern education is all those courses on the philosophy of in every discipline. How can you proceed in a discipline without having first thought about what you're doing? Why does the discipline exist? What am I trying to achieve? How can I go about it? If you don't answer those kinds of questions, then how can you do it? Are we supposed to intuitively just know what we're doing? The answer is no. And I think because people haven't thought about those issues, it is possible for them to go off in directions that otherwise they would not go in. How can someone study science without contemplating the philosophy of science? Okay. So when I first signed up and realized that there was this course, I thought, this is great. I would like to think a little bit about philosophy of history. But that course, any thinking I did about the philosophy of history in that course was all on my own time. It was not done in the course itself. But the kinds of questions that I was asking myself and I was hoping that would be addressed were questions that the historian has to answer before the historian approaches the first book of history, the first piece of evidence. And those are questions like, can we know the past? Can history be objective? Or does it always change? Is it always different from one historian to another? What constitutes valid history? When is a historical cookie and a historical account valid, true? What constitutes proof in history? Historians are always saying that so-and-so proved X. What do they mean by that? When can you say you've proved something in history? Can cause and effect be established in history? What are the causes that can be established? Those are the kinds of questions I was hoping that they would answer. None of those were really addressed. At least any that were addressed very superficially. I am going to try very briefly to give my perspective on some of history, how you look at history, using a couple of examples. And from those examples, I think you can extrapolate how I would answer these questions. And if you can't, then I can deal with them directly. What is history? My advisor has a very short statement. He says, history is something true and significant about the past. It's short, easy to remember, it's nice, and there's some qualities about that definition that I do, in fact, like. Let's think about a historical event. Let's take this class time and think about it in terms of a historical event. It's not earth-shaking. If I were to ask each of you to describe it, you would all describe it differently, as you're willing to wager. Furthermore, none of you would describe it completely. For instance, not everyone's going to mention the cars that went by. Not everyone's going to mention the number of light bulbs. Not everyone's going to mention the books on the show. Not everyone's going to mention the breeze going through. No one's going to mention the longitude and latitude. There are too many facts for anyone to record. So a historian has to use a process of selection. A historian has to figure out of everything that was true about this event, which ones are significant? Where does a historian come up with a way of evaluating the significance of any aspect of the historical event? Well, I think most historians would say that they have some kind of notion, some kind of feeling, intuition about what is significant and what is not significant. But if you really examine it, what it comes down to is their perception of the world. Their perception of the world that's already in their mind and in place before they begin investigating a particular historical event. So, in the definition that I gave you, that history is something true and significant about the past, that term significant is relative to the historian. What is significant for one historian will not be significant for another. As a result, every account of history is biased. Every account of history is built upon the historian's perspective on the world. It's unavoidable. Okay, now, given that that's true, how could you write history in a way that is meaningful, that's really helpful, that really gets at truth? Because all I'm doing is projecting my own worldview on the historical event. I am writing my views into history, into the historical account. So how can I say something that's other than just what I think? I have frequently complained to some of the other graduate students that historians find whatever they're looking for. That's essentially true. People end up substantiating their pre-existing worldview. Let me use one more example and then we'll come back to it. What I want to do is use this as an example of another aspect of history. Let's say that I ask everyone to draw a picture of that. Everyone's picture would be different. Part of it would be a change in perspective. If I drew it, you would barely see the handle. If Wes drew it, you would see the handle. So it's two different sides of the same cup. Is one true and the other one not true? I would say both are true. Both are accurate representations of what's there. Let's say that I chose to let's say that I chose to represent it this big. I made it bigger than life. Is that true or is it not true? I would say that it's true. That's an accurate representation. I just chose to blow it up bigger than life. Someone else could shrink it down. Is that an accurate representation of the cup or is it not? I would say it is. Another thing that a person could do is just draw a portion of the cup, just the top. Is that an accurate representation of the cup? I would say it is. Another person could draw it, but exaggerate the size of the handle with respect to the rest of the cup. Is that an accurate representation of the cup? I would say no. That is a caricature of the cup. So another aspect of history is not just that it is true, but that it is in right proportion, that it is not a caricature. A caricature is something that takes relatively insignificant aspects of a historical event and portrays them in a way that makes them seem larger than they really were with respect to the events of it. An excellent example is accounts that were written of the American Revolution since about 70, in the last 20 years. I suspect that this trend is no longer in vogue. But historians were going back and looking at all the records and finding evidence of class struggle in colonial America, and then projecting from there that what was really happening in the American Revolution is we had the elements of a bourgeois revolution, much like occurred in France a few years later, with the working class wanting to rise up, helping out with the initial revolution, but then being crushed by the bourgeois once the bourgeois came into power. Well, there such evidence does exist that there were members of the working class that cooperated with the revolution for economic reasons, and that those economic concerns were not addressed as a result of the revolution. There is evidence that that happened. But it has been blown completely out of proportion. It is nothing like the French Revolution. The magnitude of that aspect of the American Revolution is so infinitesimal that it's laughable. And yet these accounts try to make it sound like the American Revolution was almost like the French Revolution. And it's absurd. I suspect I could find evidence that America went to war in Vietnam to make the Arab man or something. I mean, you could come up with you could get evidence by listening to talk shows or something. You could get someone saying something like that and use that as evidence. But the question is, does that get us anywhere towards the cause? Does that explain why America was in Vietnam? If you take little bits of information, evidence, and blow them out of proportion, then you can say, aha, here we have evidence, good evidence, solid evidence, that this is why this happened. But it's out of proportion. So that's what I mean. Well, if we have nothing but the cup, there's no table, no nothing, and you want to draw an accurate representation of this, what size would you draw it? How big would it be? If I held it here, how big would it be on your paper? How big would it be now? How big would it be now? So you can choose to say, how far away did I want to be from that thing? As long as there's no other content. Once I put it on the table, now if I draw the table in one scale and the cup in another, then it ceases to be an accurate representation. But as long as I blow everything up that I've got in my drawing, then I've just chosen to look at it from a different power of magnitude in my binoculars or whatever. What I have in mind is, if you're writing a history of Western civilization, the cups become very small. But if you're writing a history of the French Revolution, the cup becomes bigger because you've zoomed in on one particular event. Neither of those is truer than the other, a more accurate representation than the other. You've just chosen to use more detail on one, focus more on one than the other. So that's what I have in mind. But once you have two different objects, they have to be in the same proportion, the same scale. Otherwise, you have distorted. Then you have terror. Okay, so then what defines correct proportion? As you're looking at a historical event, how do you keep things in correct proportion? Well, it depends on the judgment of the historian. Which causes, for instance, of the Vietnam War are the most significant? Well, what the historian does is figures out, after having looked at the evidence, the historian says, what seemed to be the most reasonable, which seemed to be the most powerful, the ones that explain the most. In other words, it ends up being the judgment of the historian. So once again, proportion is dependent upon the judgment of the historian. The better the judgment of the historian, the more accurate the account will be. So the thing that is striking once you start thinking about history is inevitably value-laden. There's a lot of judgment that goes into writing any historical account, and it's the historian's judgment, the historian's values that are going to inform how that account is written. What constitutes proof then in history? Well, I would say proof does not exist. You can't say that something has been proved or disproved. The word is used frequently in history. Historians will say that whatever someone said in the last generation has been disproved by so-and-so. But all they mean by that is that they found the arguments advanced by the so-and-so as being compelling. Why were they compelling? Or it being one of them. So proof, I would say, does not really exist. Matters of dates and names and that sort of thing are relatively trivial. When you're talking about writing history, those become relatively trivial. Obviously, it's based on those kinds of facts. But what you want to figure out is, how do these facts come together? What's underlying all of these facts? An account of history that's just facts, without any sense of selection and sense of cause and effect being woven into it, is virtually worthless. And historians are aware of that. That's not history. That's not writing. But it is a matter of judgment. It does end up being a matter of judgment, much like a jury sitting on a trial. There's evidence that has to be weighed. What is compelling evidence? The basic fact for a historian is, I have a document in my hand. There's our basic fact. And from then on, it's a matter of judgment. Is it real? Is it false? Fake? Okay, methods. Now, when they talk about historical methods, what I was surprised to learn, they mean a kind of scheme, a flow of history that the historian goes into their study of history already in place. That is, a notion as to how history unrolls is already in the historian's mind before the historian looks at history. And that notion, that kind of framework, helps the historian know what to look for, because I think it's helpful in understanding
how the approach to history has changed over time. In the early 1800s, there was an approach to history which is affectionately referred to as kings and battles. In a history department, there is nothing more derogatory to be called than a kings and battles historian. What that means is they focused on key people and key events, primarily military events. That history, that's really the essence of history. And if we know those, then we understand what has happened. Before I go any further, let me build a little chart here. This chart comes from my advisor, who uses it all the time, and I have found it helpful as well. I will end up having to add a fourth later. But these are the levels of historical experience. There are three levels at which we can think of history happening. The bottom one is economics and politics. How much do eggs cost? How much steel are we producing? Politics. Who are the senators? What are the issues? At that level, things change all daily. Things have to change all the time. The second level is at the level of institutions. That's social, political, and religious institutions. Every society develops these institutions which help to regulate and make sense of our daily experience at the third level, economics and politics. So institutions are such things as our education system, our religious organizations and the way they work and the things they believe in. We have political institutions, governmental institutions. They aren't all formal. They aren't necessarily organizations, but they are ways society has kind of ordered itself and built in certain traditions and rules that everyone accepts and believes. The first or uppermost level of historical experience is what people think, how they view things. At the third level, economics and politics, things change on a daily level. Institutions change more slowly. The thing that seems to change the most slowly is the way people think about the world, the ideology, the worldview. The kings and battles historian focuses on politics. So the kings and battles historian is saying that this is the level that is the most significant level of historical experience. Kings and battles historians, they kind of went by the wayside in the mid-1800s. But they have continued in a, the thing that came along next as a historical method that revolutionized history and other things was Marxism. Marxism, this lower level is really where it's at. And it's not politics, but it's economics that really gives you the key to what's happening. He said, if you can figure out where the money's going, what's being purchased, what's being sold, then you can project, everything else is built on that, you can project what the institutions would be in that society and what people would think in that society. Now that was an inversion from what they were saying in the realm of philosophy, in which, in particular, Hegel was saying, mentalities are what govern what human beings do. What people think is what dictates their institutions and their economics and their politics. Marx said, no, flip it right on his head. It's economics that determines all these things. Economics ultimately determines how people think. So Marxism became a historical method, and what people began to look for is what is happening in the realm of economics, and in particular, where are there class conflicts, where the class is developing, and where are there class conflicts. So Marxist historians would go back and rewrite the history of every period, basically, by looking for evidence of class conflict. Look for classes and the conflict between them. So they would go into feudal times and try to find evidence of the feudal mode of production. They'd look in a period of capitalist times, find evidence of the capitalist mode of production developing, etc. Now, one thing that was stressed in Marxism was, and it was a complete departure from the kings and battles historians, is Marxism stressed the anonymous, the crowd. So there were a lot of books that historical books that came out that stressed the activity of the mob, the crowd, in which no person becomes history. And it was a real rejection of kings and battles history. And that influence has not changed. The assumption is still that it's the common man that you want to really look at. After Marx came Weber, I don't understand Weber's method extremely well, but he said, no, it's not economic. It really is ideas that drive history. This is the basic level of history, the fundamental level of history. You have to know what people are thinking in order to understand what's going on. And Weber had this idea. Marx had believed that history was progressing. It started out an ancient mode of production, an ancient economy, a slave economy. It progressed to a feudal economy, which had serfdom, and that progressed to a capitalist economy, and that we were moving towards socialism, and in socialism, things would be wonderful. All class conflict would be resolved, and people would be whole again. Weber said, no, that's not the way history is going. And Weber looked at society and said, all I see happening is bureaucracy is getting strengthened. And from revolution or whatever comes along, the end result is a stronger and more entrenched bureaucracy. We call that rationalization of government. That is, it becomes more efficient, makes more sense, more solid. And he predicted that where history was going was we were headed towards the Iron Age, in which a kind of faceless bureaucracy dominated and took over society. And the only relief that can come from that is an occasional charismatic leader that will come along, and people will rally around the charismatic leader, and there will be a period of reprieve. But history is essentially headed towards the Iron Age. Bureaucracy will continue to grow. The reaction to Weber was a method referred to as the Annales School. This was a school of history centered around a journal called the Annales Journal. And what they said is, none of this stuff matters. These things change, they come and go. What we really need to look at is what are called structures in society. That is, look at a family. How's a family organized? Does that change? Well, it changes over long, long periods of time, but it changes very slowly. Anything above that line changes too fast to be of any significance. What they're going to say is things like geography is a driving force behind history. It's at that kind of, we're looking at geological change. We're looking at change over centuries, not change over years. That's the kind of change that's significant. The main proponent of this particular perspective is Bourdieu, François Bourdieu, who wrote on perspective. All those things above the line are considered dust on history. They come and go. The things that are really important are those things that are built into society that can really rise over time. He would say perhaps that these are significant. He would say, you look at revolutions, they don't change anything. You can have whole populations wiped out and other populations move in if there's some overlap and you see similar things happening. So where's the change? The way families are organized. Yes, how they relate to their environment. It makes sense that he's basically an ancient historian. I think it'd be harder to apply this, and people from the school tend to be ancient. Okay, but then the modern trends that have developed since this, these kind of come and go, I still Marxism is one of the dominant forces in history, but it seems in the last 10 years it's been kind of faded. But what we're seeing, what I'm seeing now, is one is values free history. There are people that believe that you could write history that made no judgment. So you could write a history about Hitler, for instance, and not make any, and say that there is no judgment that can be made here, because history can't make judgments. And it's an attempt to be objective in the sense of not making any judgment. So in an account of Hitler, what you describe is, this is what happened, this many people were killed, and all that sort of thing. But you could not make any judgment. Well, that's exactly, it's fallen apart because just by selection, there are values that are being made. And I think that's becoming more and more obvious to everyone. There can be no such thing as obviously. The next one is, and this is one that I do not understand, and that's postmodernism. And this perspective says, trash all these. It can't be done. You can't have a framework. You can't come up with a unifying scheme of history. There is no thread that runs through history. Weber would have stressed institutions as well as ideas. So they were not ahead of their time. Postmodernism came right at the right time, right after modernism. To my understanding, what they're saying is, they use the image of an oak tree. And what they say is, if you have an oak tree, all of the past methods, historical methods, have assumed that they know where the trunk is and where the branches go. And then they find the leaves are micro-histories of little counts of history. We know the trunk and the branches that make sense of all these little pieces of history. The postmodernist says, but you can never see the trunk, you can never see the branches, all you see is the leaves. The trunk and the branches are all an extrapolation from the location of the leaves. And they're right. So what they say is, all we know are leaves. We can't come up with a unifying thread through history, or a way to bring all these events together. All we have are isolated events. And it is futile, and in fact misleading, to try to make sense of these isolated historical events. Now, the problem in postmodernism is any postmodernist historian that I have read ends up telling history much like someone from one of these other camps would do. So when it comes right down to it, they do have a framework that kind of leads to. But their argument is there cannot be a framework. Construct that, therefore, you need to write the tree. Yeah, well, that's what they do the most of. I see a tree there. Those leaves can't hide it. I see a tree there. Well, that's what they do most of. They go around saying, you've got a tree. They do very little of looking at their own work and saying, I've got a tree too. Then the last thing, and this isn't a school yet, but it's a trend that I am seeing among graduate students in history, and that is history as a teacher of morality. It needs to have a shorter name than that to be really catchy, but this is surprisingly strong among the graduate students and the really young historians. They have absolutely rejected this. This is repulsive to them, to think of value-free history. From their perspective, history ought to teach morality. It ought to teach value. That's why you study history. So what they do is they say, I know what issue I would like to bring to people's attention. Then they go back in history to find an example of where that shows up such that they can keep the value that they want to teach. And typically where you see that is in the issues of the environment, racism, and one that's coming up, it's not too far downstream, homophobia. That there are certain issues that we already know what's right and wrong. What we need to do is go back in history and find examples which point up the right and the wrong. And that's what they go about here. And that's the kind of thing that I expect we'll see more and more in the next few years. Columbus, I think, is an outstanding example of that. The account of Columbus has been completely rewritten. I was reading books on Columbus to my kids. Susan went to the library and checked some of them out. And it's like about 5 or 6 years ago. If they're dated before that, Columbus was this wonderful guy who discovered the New World, made it possible for us to come over here and have a wonderful time and all that sort of thing. And then about 5 years ago, he turned into the most disgusting, vile creature that ever crawled on the face of the earth. And all he came over here for was to exploit the Indians, and it goes on and on. It is night and day, there's a dividing line, that something happened there. Columbus changed. And it's just incredible. But we're going to see, I think we're going to see an awful lot of that in the next few years. Okay, so these are the frameworks. Things have kind of moved, but the striking thing is, you show me a book on history, And I can come pretty close to telling you when it was written, because they fall into these categories pretty well. You can tell by the flavor, the kinds of things they pick out as being important, the kinds of things they attack. You can tell by those indicators when it was written.
That indicates that all the historians are sheep, and that if they're all going the same direction at the same time.
Well, there's certainly an element of that. That what a historian ends up doing is learning the profession. And the profession has kind of industry standards. And you learn what those are, and you either abide by them, or you... But there is... This does present a problem, and that is the historian in history. Are we finding an account of what happened, or are we finding what's in the mind of the historian? If history changes with each of these phases, that should make us pause and think, what has changed here? Are there new facts that have been dug up? Usually the new facts that have been dug up are, there's a reevaluation of those facts in light of a new perspective that's coming out. For instance, with Columbus, it's not that just before the 500th anniversary, all of a sudden you have a lot more evidence. The evidence is the same evidence that was around 10 years ago, and yet the account of history has changed dramatically. Well, the fashion has changed. So historians look at it kind of skeptically and they say, there is no history. All there are accounts of what's going on in the mind of the king. Carr criticizes that. He says that his perspective is we need to work to stay away from that. We need to be more grounded. We need to be more objective in order to keep from having the fashion influence. I'm convinced, however, that there is thread to history. There is a direction to history, and that it can serve. We have to have some kind of framework. You can't do what the postmodernists are saying. You can't get rid of the whole framework, because your framework comes out of your worldview. How you see the world dictates how you evaluate information, and no one is without a worldview. So we have to have a worldview. We have to have a framework. You can't just have raw information and have history. You haven't accomplished anything. There's a pile of facts now on your table. We have to make sense of it. Make sense of it, you have to have a framework. Now the question is, what framework are we going to use? Do we use the next one that comes down the line? Or is there something that makes better sense? And I think there's something that makes better sense. And that is a framework that is biblically informed. I think that's the escape out of the fashion thing, is we have to attach the framework to something that is fixed and something that is true, and that is God's perspective on the world. So I am going to start next week to try to chart out, I'm going to explain what I see as the thread that runs through history that I think reflects the Bible's perspective on history. And then I'm going to start charting what I consider the nodal points in history and explain how those points fit into that thread, how they make sense of it, how they are building on it.